Our subject this morning is spiritualizing relationships. We had an interesting talk recently on the subject of how to humanize our relationship with God. That is to say that if we want to know God, we have to develop those human qualities that are magnetic before we can hope to understand the kind of magnetism it takes to realize God. It's true that you transcend human magnetism and human personality and attitudes, but you need to start with what you know and make it spiritual. And in that loyalty, in that devotion, in that friendliness, in all those qualities that it takes to really make friends, you find the basic attitudes that it takes also to realize God. That's why Yogananda said that in order to realize God, you have to have at least one perfect relationship with another person. It doesn't have to be a romantic relationship. It can be a friendly one. It can be father and son or mother and daughter or whatever. But the idea of that is that we perfect our humanity before we can transcend that humanity. The idea of it also is that it helps to bring into sharp focus, like the famous humorist P.G. Woodhouse said that he visualized actors acting the roles of his characters, and that way was able to bring them into a sharp enough focus to make them real and believable. You'll find that we, by visualizing a thing very clearly, we understand it more. I found that in trying to understand some philosophical point that was too subtle and getting away from me, that if I would just bring it down to a human level where I could see it in terms of actual examples, where I could understand it on my level, then I could see, in that case, this is how that line of thinking would naturally develop. But if you jump to the abstract without having understood the concrete, then you'll never really understand the abstract either. I've always felt that if a person can't make an idea simple so that anyone could understand it, then he hasn't understood it yet himself. People who believe that they are being profound by being obscure haven't really reached the possibility of being profound. Profundity is always at its very basis simple. In fact, that's the great problem we face in our effort to find truth. It isn't that truth is complex, it's that we are complex. Or to put it more clearly, we have complexes. We have so many different directions that we go in and different motives that we can't even understand our own motives clearly. And in order to understand the relationship that we can achieve with God, we need to first of all, bring it down out of those sort of intellectual abstractions that you find so common and so dear to the minds, if not the hearts, of philosophers who will speak of categorical imperatives and cosmic grounds of being and all sorts of abstractions. Very learned, most impressive, but look at these people and see where they've actually gotten with it all. Are they shining examples? Usually they're sort of dusty scholars. And really, if you want to know the infinite, then get to know yourself. And finally, you'll discover that that self is an expression of the infinite. And you'll understand it in higher and higher relations. The other side of that coin is equally important, and that's our subject this morning. That is to say that if we must have an ideal human relationship, or if we need to understand how to have beautiful spiritual relationships first in order to know God, then we have to know how to achieve, how to turn it the other way around, how to have the right kind of relationship that will help us to know God. I didn't make that equation very well. I meant to say, if we can only approach God in terms of the kinds of relationships that we've developed, then what we need to do also is understand that not every kind of relationship will bring us to God, even if it seems very nice on an ordinary human level. You can't find God until you can understand how to get along with man. You can't understand how to get along with man until you've understood how to love God. The two go inextricably side by side. They're opposite sides of the same coin. Master said to a disciple, "You shouldn't love people, you should love God." And sometime later he asked the disciple, "Do you love people?" And the disciple said, "No, I love only God." And Master said, "You should love people." And the disciple was very confused. He said, "Well, what do you mean, sir?" And Master replied, "You should love God first, and then with his love, love people." The first and most important cue to understanding how to love man is to learn how to love God. And yet to love God in a way that includes the love of man, or it becomes abstract. The two go side by side. Well, it's sort of like the dilemma I faced in starting Ananda. How do you start a community without people? But how do you get people without having a community? And in the beginning it was difficult, but it was not an impossible equation. It was that you get a little bit of this, and then you get a little bit of the other, and then you can get a little bit more of this, and then a little bit more of the other. In other words, the first people I spoke to about starting Ananda all denounced me as somebody who was trying to take them for something. And I thought, well, I haven't been able to make clear what it is I'm trying to do. So I sat down and wrote the book, How to Cooperative Communities, How to Start Them and Why. And then a few people read this and decided, well, that sounds pretty good. And so they came and started a community. And with those people, we were able to get more of a community going. And as we had more of a community going, more and more people came. And it took a little while. It took in the beginning, there was absolutely no self-definition. Everybody, that is to say, had his own definition. And everybody was pulling it in his way. Ah, cooperative community, this is what it should be. Ah, spiritual community, this is what it should be. And everybody was pulling in his own direction. And it took a lot of patience and slowly working it out and working with those who wanted to do a good thing rather than merely a selfish thing. And bit by bit, it came to the point where there developed such a sense of self-definition that pretty soon people began to understand what Ananda was really trying to be. And then people who were in tune with that began arriving, and those who weren't began leaving. And bit by bit, it all sort of worked out. It'll probably be a process that will continue for a long time to come. There's nothing in life that's absolutely this or that. I was talking with friends of ours from Illinois who have had a community there for many years. And the difficulty is that people want to come here. They don't want to be there yet. And I said, that's natural in the beginning. Ananda will create a magnetism, has created a magnetism that draws people here. And why would they want to be somewhere else if they're sincere and naturally want to be where the action is? But it will happen over a period of time that this implosion will reach a point of diminishing returns. You'll start thinking, well, it's nice to be here because this is where the action is, but there's so much of it, it's confusion. And then what do we do about it? And then we'll find people wanting to go out. And to some extent, we're doing that already by sending people out to Italy and other places. I used to want to have a loosely knit sort of brotherhood of independent and autonomous communities, but I finally had to face the reality here that anybody who is sincerely committed to Ananda and to what we're doing wouldn't want to go off and separate himself. And those who do want to wouldn't be representative. And so naturally we end up in that same sort of bind that organizations find themselves in of getting too big. And I don't suppose there's ever a fixed and final answer to these human predicaments, these dilemmas, because man is a growing and breathing thing. It's necessary that somebody was saying, talking about rebirthing and living forever and so on. And I said, Who would want such a situation? Think of a poor artist starting out his career now, stuck with somebody like Michelangelo, who's been around for 500 or 600 years, and and can just paint him into a corner with no problem. We've got to clear the deck so new people can come along. And thus it is that always you will find that life continues. You can't have one fixed answer that will ever endure forever. You always have to look for solutions that are pertinent to this particular problem at this time, hoping that they'll go in a further direction. I suppose in time we will indeed have groups that will go out and start more and more communities from Ananda as that implosion reaches that point of diminishing returns and then wants to reach out. And I hope that it can be a point of such freedom that there can be a certain sense of autonomy without feeling that people have cut themselves off from what's going on here, and that the bond will be more spiritual than institutional. But we'll have to see as it goes. The issue at point here in this discussion is that it's never either or. The more you have of one, the more easy it will be to get something of the other. And so, by trying to develop an ideal relationship with people, well, to put it the other way around, leaving God out of the picture completely, you'll never have it. And if you try to get a complete relationship with God and not think about people at all, the chances are you won't have a relationship with God either. Master said that if the missionaries had only meditated, they'd all have found God. The idea being that they weren't being selfish and just thinking of advancing for themselves. They were also thinking in terms of sharing. And if they had only combined that sharing with inwardly seeking, then they would have had the ideal combination. Swami Sivananda said the same thing about government servants in India, the same thing on the other side of the coin, who with their pensions would buy and would build cottages on the Ganges up near Rishikesh and never get anywhere spiritually, he said, because they aren't serving people. They're only thinking of their own growth. The two have to go side by side. It's perfectly clear, however, that in our relationship with people, we have a great deal to learn to reach that kind of that level of a relationship that will really help us to understand the godly way of relating. And if it's merely being a good Joe and getting along with people on a clap hands, here comes Charlie basis, then the chances of ever finding God become somewhat remote. He doesn't work that way. You can't vote your way into paradise. You can't get elected there by being popular. I've seen some people like this, that they're so interested and so they need so much reassurance for themselves that their whole energy is spent in trying to win other people's support, win other people's love and approval and everything, and they think once they've got it that they're doing fine. But God is often on that side, which is completely the opposite of what everybody else seems to want. I mean, look at the world. How few people have found God. They're all trying to be popular, but they haven't found God. It's a very important thing that we understand what we mean when we speak of humanizing our devotion. And the cue to that, the key to it, is to spiritualize our relations, or, to put it in another way, to seek God first, and then to see God in others. To love God and then try to relate to other people in a godly way. Now, this might mean, indeed, that people won't like you. Most people, probably, they'll like you if they haven't any kind of stake in what you're doing. But they won't like you otherwise, because you will be fiercely, or not fiercely, but firmly independent. You will be seeking to be guided not by what they like or want, but by the truth that you see within yourself. We had a big difficulty with our neighbors here a couple of years ago, as you all know. And some of them were at my house, we were talking things out, and you said, I'm not interested in opinions, in your opinions or in my opinions, or in what you want or what I want. I'm interested in what is true. what is right. And I was so astonished when this man replied, "My man, that really makes me feel bad. That really makes me worried." He couldn't understand a level of thinking that didn't relate to opinions, likes and dislikes, desires. The only reason for doing a thing is that you like it, not that it's right or wrong. Most people can't understand that. Jesus said that if you will live in the right way, in a godly way, you will be persecuted, because worldly people cannot understand a person trying to live by truth, trying to live from within himself. They'll feel that, listen, I've shouted at you loudly enough and you still haven't heard me. As if shouting did it in the first place. One quiet reason, if it's a true reason, should be enough to convince any man of goodwill. But their way of living is like what Master described in Autobiography of a Yogi. Reason had forsaken him, he could only shout. Or like people who go to foreign countries like France and talk in English, and somebody doesn't understand them, so they talk louder in English. Finally, they're shouting at the tops of their lungs in English and can't understand why they aren't being heard. Well, what we need to do in working with people is not to be concerned. If we want to spiritualize our relationships, we've got to take them above the level of desire and of likes and dislikes and of opinions. Opinions don't even matter. Truth matters. If you hold an opinion that proves to be wrong, you should be willing to relinquish it in a second. What if you're thinking of losing face? You will gain much more face for your honesty to truth than you ever would for clinging blindly to a falsity or a false opinion. There was a marvelous George Price cartoon in the New Yorker a few years ago of this dowager kind of woman, the woman who obviously was accustomed to commanding and having her will obeyed in the slightest whim, had a whim of steel, you might say. A plane is already taking off, the plane that she's obviously trying to catch, and she's at the top of the steps leading up to the plane, and the attendants are rushing after, pushing this staircase after the retreating plane. And she's standing there like this with her finger raised. It's sort of like the story of Canute with the waves. There were these courtiers who were always flattering Canute and trying to tell him that he could do anything at all, that he commanded the elements and so on. And he was a wise man, and he saw through this and wasn't going to accept it. But it got to the point where finally he thought, well, let me show them a lesson. He said, "You say I can control the elements?" "Oh, yes, yes, Your Majesty." "The waves too?" "Yes, Your Majesty." So he said, "Well, take me down to the ocean." And he took them down, and the tide was coming in, and he sat there in his chair and commanded the tide to go out, and it just kept coming closer and closer, and the courtiers began forsaking him and all rushing for dry land. But indeed, we have to have that kind of attitude that is rooted in spiritual values. And spiritual values, let's face it, are basically not popular. They never will be popular until maybe we reach a more spiritual age. But in this day and age, the very act of taking your stand to seek God will put most people even violently against you. I've been amazed to see how true that is in relations with people who are seemingly wanting to do a good thing. But I see that the basic difference is that they cannot accept that you're doing anything except for selfish motive. The reason they can't accept it is that they don't do anything without selfish motive. And it's the only possible way to live. And so they figure that you're being underhanded by not coming out and admitting, frankly, what it is you're trying to get out of it. But the godly way doesn't have any selfish motive. And I found that people who come to me and try to become friends with me and have some sort of self-interest, what's in it for me kind of thinking, that I tend to sort of back off from them, because they haven't that attitude that makes for sincere divine friendship. Doesn't make it possible. There has to be a sense of We are doing this together. We are living together for God. What can I do to help? How can we together help to advance a cause? But never the thought of what can I get out of it. It's as if there were two different races involved here. And the one never seems to understand the other. That once you get really onto the spiritual path and you begin to think in terms of God and giving up the ego and so on, it becomes totally foreign to your nature to think of, well, you weigh your opportunities and think, where can I get my advantage? You become a merchant in that way of thinking, and you'll never achieve spiritual development. You have to be in a giving way. You have to try to help other people, not for what they mean to you. Most people will be interested in helping you. This is why I don't have any use for the average encounter group or the average whatever they call these things. They have many different names for them, but they all turn out to be the same basic thing where people sit around and either criticize or suggest or whatever, but they put their values onto you, and their values are rarely right. They will be telling you that if you come to the meetings feeling very peaceful, they'll say, what are you acting so high and mighty about? One little example. And so what do? You sit there and you think, gee, well, I'm here to learn. Maybe I'm acting high and mighty. And so you start thinking, what can I do? And try to become more real by pretending you're not high and mighty, by coming down on a level where you're no longer peaceful. They think that you're being insincere because you're not shouting. Well, you've got to be angry about this. Listen, what's the matter with you? Can't you be sincere? And pretty soon you think, well, gee, maybe I should. And so you start shouting. And you don't feel like shouting, but you shout. Because I remember this one woman. She was the secretary of the Dutton Club at the Unitarian Church many years ago. And she invited me to come and sing there. And somehow she had enough confidence in me to sort of open up her heart and tell me what her problems were and so on. And her basic problem was that she wanted a husband. And so she said that I joined this Dutton Club thinking that I would find a husband, and I find that it's full of nothing but women looking for husbands. And what do I do? And she wasn't really asking for advice. She was just sort of looking for a shoulder to cry on. And so finally she told me that she had joined Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, well, you're not alcoholic, are you? Well, she said, I had a daiquiri once. But she said, it's wonderful, there are all these men and I'm the only woman. And I said to them, you know, I don't really think I'm alcoholic. And they said, oh, everybody says that. So she felt all right, she was justified. And finally, one day I called her to see about a lecture at the church there, and there was no answer. Her phone had been disconnected, and I thought, ah, she found him at last. But there you have it, this value system of, well, everybody says that, but of course. And you get onto that level, and it's very hard to get out because the kind of feedback you get from people, this was not an encounter group in this case, but all their great effort to try to get her onto the wagon and off drinking when she had something else in mind altogether. That's what these encounter groups will often be, because people being blind will only be feeding their own blindness. It's sort of like the blind leading the blind. When I know people who go to psychics and astrologers and so on, and they won't get more wisdom than the person himself has. You don't get wisdom by looking at a chart. If you haven't any wisdom in yourself, the chart will tell you nothing. I remember one article that came out in the astrological magazine in India praising Jawaharlal Nehru, calling him spiritual and noble and his ideals and a great leader and all this stuff. Then later on, Nehru came out with a public blast against astrology. And so somebody else read his horoscope and found in it, and this article appeared in the same magazine. Ignoble, low ideals, unspiritual. You can read into a horoscope whatever you're looking for. I was reading a book about different configurations, and I think it's Heinke, is that his name? I forget. Anyway, it's pretty drastic. If you'd believe this book, half of my considerations would mean that I was a foe of society, would probably spend my life in prison, and all sorts of things that you can't find any combination that doesn't have some potential for this. For example, my son in the 12th house means probably being incarcerated for life. But a spiritual astrologer would say, ah, such a person would seek seclusion. And the same configuration read by two people of very different outlook, and they can make very opposite things of it. In fact, people who come to spiritual communities often have their sun in the 12th house because it implies a wish to live more of an inner life. But don't look to astrologers for wisdom. They may be able to tell you when it's a good time to get married or take a journey or something like this. They may tell you a little bit about your nature, but first check them. See whether they are wise. And if they're wise, they probably can tell you it without a horoscope. In fact, I remember one time I was on a plane going somewhere or coming from somewhere, and just for the fun of it, I guess this whoever was sitting next to me on the plane was talking about palmistry, and I don't know how it happened, but I read his palm. And I don't know anything about palmistry, virtually nothing. And he was saying, hey, wow, that's terrific. And he was going back and telling all the other passengers, and this was back in the days of propeller planes, and so it was a smaller plane. And all these passengers were coming up and asking me to read their palms. And they were all very impressed. I think probably I got more by looking at their eyes and then saying, oh, yes. But you... The whole thing really becomes an intuitive thing anyway. Putting my mind in that mode and looking at the palm, and it suddenly did seem to say a few little things, and so I talked about it. But the point is that wisdom is much more important than a psychic who pretends all sorts of insight but doesn't have wisdom will give you advice that isn't necessarily good. And the fact that you were Tutankhamen in Egypt is not really relevant to the present moment. The thing that's relevant is that here you are and you've got present dilemmas. So the thing to do is to try to relate to and be with people who are wise. I've often had this excuse given back to me. If I'll say something to somebody, oh, but so many people feel differently. Well, okay, follow whomever you want. But, you know, not always are people right. They do make an occasional mistake here and then. Don't listen to opinions. Consult ultimately your own heart. And ask yourself, is it true or not? Because that's where the ultimate guidance goes. But going to somebody who's wise, going to somebody who has more experience, this too can be a very, very important aspect to achieving the divine consciousness. The person who's wise may say something that you reject totally, and yet if you follow it may turn out to be just the right thing. How to achieve this? Always by trying to have with people a divine relationship. And what you will find is that the more you have a relationship with God, the more it turns around and you have that kind of divine relationship with people who don't have a divine relationship with anybody else. That somehow you draw something out of them that makes them, in that context, different people. That you are looking at God in them, and they respond to the way you see them, and it draws the best out of them. I've seen this in the presence of saints. that people somehow begin to develop faith in their own potential, faith in their own basic goodness. And where other people would put them down and tell them how bad they were, suddenly in the presence of these spiritually minded people or these saints, they began to think, well, bad or not, still, I'm a child of God. And pretty soon they stop thinking of themselves as bad. And that's basically all we have to do is convince ourselves that we are godly. Convince ourselves not in the sense of self-delusion, but in the sense of actually attuning ourselves to that aspect of our nature. We all have it. The worst criminal has it, because we've all come from God. Ultimately, we all have to go back to Him. To spiritualize your relationships, then, try to intensify, first of all, your relationship with God, and then to see God in them and to serve them in His name rather than in their name. Don't be interested in what they think of you. Don't be interested in whether they like you. That's one of the greatest pitfalls in really spiritualizing relationships. Do it because you love God. Do it because you love God in them. Do it because you love something higher in them than their present attitudes or their opinions. Do it because it's right. Do it because it feels good to love them and to be kind. But don't do it with any expectation of a return, even from them, in the sense of approval or anything like that. The more it's better to do good for approval than not to do good at all. But it's better not to do it for approval, but only to please God, only to serve Him. If you act in this way, if you put out the right kind of magnetism, what will happen is that you begin to draw to you people who do understand, people who are in tune, and with whom you can relate in a one-to-one basis, not just from you to them, but back from them to you in a godly way. I remember back when I was living with my parents and back in the scene there in Scarsdale, New York, being absolutely convinced that there was no spirituality in this country. I was going to leave America because I didn't see anybody interested in spiritual values. And yet when I came to Mount Washington, I found everybody was spiritual. And it showed me that there are many different worlds going on simultaneously. When I lived in Charleston, South Carolina, it's a small enough town for one to be able to see people from various levels, various strata of society. And because I wanted to be a playwright, I wanted to mix with people of all types and get to sort of see how they functioned on different levels. And it was an interesting experience. But what particularly interested me was how quickly people would find their own particular milieu. That within a day or two of arriving in Charleston, they would have already found the people whom they were in tune with. If they were criminal types, they'd have found the criminals. The police are still looking for them. They'd have found them already. Everybody would find his own type quickly because he generated that kind of magnetism. And so it is that as our magnetism changes, we find that automatically people are drawn to us who have a similar interest, and people are sort of alienated or they lose interest if there isn't that potential for spirituality emanating from our particular magnetism that we're developing. The most important way then to spiritualize your relationships is not only to attune yourself with God and to try to see God in everybody, but to make yourself godly, to generate that kind of spirituality, to be a spiritual friend to others. You'll find that if you love them purely, if you don't want anything out of them, if your only interest is in doing what you can for them, and if you're not trying to impose your values on them, but giving them the freedom to be themselves, that then you will begin to attract wonderful friends. This is what we have here at Ananda. We have wonderful friendships here because they're based in this consciousness. I remember a number of years ago, there was a couple who wanted to leave Ananda. And they had been living in a bus. We didn't have much in the way of living accommodations in those days. And just about a week before their intended departure, their bus caught fire and they lost everything they owned in that bus. The wonderful thing about it was that the community, knowing that these people were leaving, all pitched in and gave them clothes and dishes and money and anything that would make it possible for them to be able to leave comfortably. And I don't know many communities that would have done that. They would have turned their backs on these people and had nothing to do with them because they were leaving God and all this nonsense. The fact is that when you have that kind of friendship for people that doesn't think in terms of, oh, they belong to our club, or, oh, they're doing something for us, or anything selfish, just what can we do to help other people? How can we, not even thinking in terms of Ananda as the periphery, it's a large periphery because it's a large family, but realizing that Ananda's a part of the whole world, and what's good for the world will be good for Ananda, and if it hurts the world, it's bad for Ananda, even if it looks good temporarily. We have to have that kind of expansive love that isn't particular in its relations, that doesn't think in terms of I and mine. The average motherly love is really only partly selfless, and to a large extent also selfish. I love this child because he's mine. And if he died and was born next door, would you still love him? There has to be that basic love that we love people because they are our brothers and sisters in God. And we can't love them that way until we love God. How can we have that kind of relationship with people then? I think that the most important thing, to bring it down to something that we can all sort of hold to and live by, is to be centered in ourselves. Because the opposite is to be centered in other people and clinging to them and, oh, please give me love, please give me approval, please smile at me, please give me whatever it is. And if you're centered in yourself, then you don't need from them. If that self-centeredness becomes self-centeredness in ego, of course it's bad. If you just say, I don't need you, and leave them like that. But if you don't need anybody in a positive sense because you have God, then you find that you're willing to give to them not out of need, but out of love. That all comes from being centered in yourself. If you can do that, then everything will work for the best. So try in your relations with people not to play the popularity game. I've always remembered a little scene. Sometimes these little flash instances remain in our memory as indicative of a great deal more. I was in New Delhi and I was trying to find the home ministry. And I went up to three people who were standing outside at the government offices there. It was an American and two Indians. And the American was trying to charm the Indians. He was there sort of working on a government-to-government level, I suppose, and he was trying to make them feel how our country's really with you folks, you know. So he was there being charming. And the Indians were just calmly centered in themselves and listening and smiling and being polite and not at all putting him down. And I came up to them to ask them how to get to the home ministry. And the Indians turned around politely and just waited for me to say what it was I wanted. And the American, like this, okay, Joe, you're on, what do you want? And it was so funny to see that contrast, because in fact it struck my mind that you never see Indians behave like that. I remember a friend of mine in this country years ago asking me to give her a suggestion for how she could change. And I had just come from Mexico, where I saw people, at least in this respect, were much more centered. And I was thinking of someone I had met there, and I said to this lady, this friend, it would be good if you could be more dignified. And she was very hurt by this, but in fact it was the truth, it was what was needed. Dignity doesn't mean pomposity. Dignity means to be centered in yourself. And then everything you do flows graciously and gracefully from that center. But we need to learn to become, to have our center, to find that center, and then always to act from that center. There isn't anything that I know comparable in effectiveness to Kriya Yoga for helping people to achieve that centeredness. Because it's always working at the center. It's always bringing that energy and that sense of being to the center. And you're always working from there. And it becomes second nature then, living here, to do everything from that. You'll find that then you become so fixed in yourself that nothing really can sway you. People can come to you with all their pent-up emotions, and you just quietly remain centered. And what becomes beautiful then is that you don't mind how they behave. It's their problem. You don't have to take it as yours. And so you're always there to help out, no matter how they treat you, no matter how they hate you. If suddenly they need your help, you're there giving it, and their so-called friends aren't. It was like that beautiful story of Buddha, who one time was walking with his disciples, and a prostitute, seeing him, fell in love with him and came to him and spoke of her love for him. And to the enormous consternation of his disciples, he said to her, "I love you too." And they did their best to drag him away. And he said to her, "When you need me," she said, "Come with me then." And he said, "When you need me, that's when I'll come." Well, this wasn't something the disciples understood, and they were worried to death. Anyway, years later, he suddenly jumped up from his seat, and he said, "My beloved, the prostitute is calling me. She needs me." And he went toward her, and they were all running after him, hoping desperately to save him. And when they arrived, they found him with her head in his lap. She had contracted some terrible disease, something like leprosy. All her beauty was gone, and all her friends had gone, and he was healing her. And she became healed and whole again, and became one of his most sincere disciples. Because then she understood that ordinary human love is not really worth anything. Ordinary sexual love is not worth anything. But his love was not for her body, it was for her soul. And because she understood no other language, therefore he talked to her in words she could understand, but he meant something much, much deeper. Those people, with all their popularity that they may have, all the friends that they may have, those friends won't be with them in time of need. Those friends won't be with them when their own egoic satisfactions have ceased, when they no longer can find anything to get out of this relationship. They'll leave it. Only godly people, only saintly people will be with you in such times. Most people don't love you. They love themselves. I would say that it's not possible for them to love you unless they love with God's love. That's why that beautiful song that Master sang, "In this world no one can love me. In this world no one knows how to love me. E prithibir keo bhalo to bashena." In this world, nobody knows how to love. Because they're loving, what they give isn't love. It's self-love, it's desire, it's attachment. Only God can love, and we can only love others with His love. So if you act in that way, there are all sorts of other things that you could do in order to spiritualize your relationships, but I think that they will fall into place perfectly naturally. You won't have to work at them. You'll find that automatically you don't react to people in a disharmonious way. You won't react emotionally. That's one of the worst ways. Those things which are corrosive to friendship are emotional reactions, saying things that aren't really carefully thought through. The mouth is like a cannon, and the words that we shoot out are often like bullets that can destroy friendship, can destroy, in one sentence, a friendship of maybe many, many years. But you'll find that automatically, when you have that kind of respect, when you have that kind of centeredness, you don't just speak because something comes into your mind to say it. Not everything that you say is going to be divine, for heaven's sake. Watch your words. Stand guard at the gate and let those go out that you really want to represent you. An organization that sends out people to represent it that haven't had any training is likely to be in hot water quickly. You train people and you make sure they know how to represent you before you let them out. Let your words be that way too. let them really represent you and not merely be blurted out in the name of representing you. What you can say in an emotional sentence may be all the right words even and still not come out right. Oh, I love you. Doesn't sound like love at all, does it? You know, you can even say, oh, I hate you, and say it in such a way that you know the person's saying, I love you. The words are of secondary importance. It's the consciousness behind them. Get yourself calm before you speak and think about how your words can be understood. Can they be misconstrued? I was very interested when writing The Path. I would read chapter by chapter to the community members at my house on Thursday nights. And I was really intrigued to see how something that was crystal clear to me would sometimes be understood in even the opposite way by certain people. And I'd look at it again and I'd see, well, that construction could be put on those words, and I have had to change them a little bit. But it's amazing how what you say and what you mean, once it's been taken in by somebody else and translated into his own subjective language, it may have another meaning altogether. So don't only speak words that are meaningful to you, but think, will they mean something to the other person? We've often laughed about my experience that I had when I came back from India in 1962, and I was going down to Big Sur, and there was a bridge that was being constructed, and for a while we had to get out of the car and wait till they could put something in place again so we could cross the bridge. And while I was standing with the various passengers from other cars there, somebody came up to me and he said, say man, can you tell me how a cat can get around the world without any bread? I'd never heard of hippies before, and I wasn't accustomed to be called man. I had other... and then cats, I didn't know they had wanderlust, and besides, I didn't realize they ate bread. And people who just talk without thinking, well, will this person understand me? Try to think of where he's coming from, what his understanding of a situation would be. What is he capable of grasping? If you talk even a true spiritual... if you give him a true spiritual message, but he's not on a level to appreciate it, it won't mean anything to him at all. You might as well save your breath. Try to translate it into terms that he will recognize and respond to in a positive way. And then, for example, supposing this is an absurd example almost, but I think there are people capable of matching it. Somebody comes to you and says that I just lost my wife and I feel so badly, or a mother comes and says, oh, I just lost my child, he was killed in a car accident. It's all a dream, nothing matters. Your child didn't die, he didn't live. Is this going to be meaningful to that woman at that time? I can imagine that neophyte yogis would answer in that way. It would be a perfectly true answer. But it would be a pointless answer to make unless he's dealing with a real Advaitin, in which case I don't think that person would come crying. But a more appropriate answer, if you want to give that kind of message, would be Buddha's answer to that woman who came to him and said that her only child, her only son, had died and wanted him to bring her back to life, bring him back to life. And Buddha said, bring some rice from a home that has not seen death. And the woman thought, well, that's simple. Nobody else could have had this problem but me. And she came back after a long day of seeking from home to home, and she said, Master, I haven't found a single home where there has been no death. And he smiled compassionately, and she understood. But she was able to understand by that time because she'd had the experience. If he had said to her, oh, death means nothing at all, get away from me, it's all a dream anyway, I don't think it would have quite got in the same way. When you deal with people, I think one of the most important qualities to have if you want to spiritualize your relationships with them is respect. To respect where they are coming from, respect what their needs are, respect their freedom to be themselves, even if they are ignorant. Respect their freedom to be ignorant and to grow out of their ignorance at their own rate. Don't impose your values on them. All of this will come if you're sufficiently centered in yourself, because it's from wherever you are that you will see others. If you live at your center, you will see the center of other people too. And if you understand them from their center, then you will understand that which will help them to reach that center. You won't be talking to a superficial level. You will understand that which will be the right advice to give them at that particular time. And it may be advice that you'll never give anybody else, but it will be right for them. It will be what they need. I don't think in relationships that it's ever wise to say anything except lightly, to say anything serious, unless you first pray. And I don't mean that as soon as you're about to say something serious, you excuse yourself and dash off to your meditation room. I don't mean that you have to sit there and close your eyes and start chanting Om. Be human, be natural. But you can just mentally, without letting them know that's what you're doing, just mentally say, God, what should I say? Or Master, what should I say? Or better still, what should we say? So that you have a kind of partnership going there. It need only be for a moment, but if you put enough energy into it, then you very often will get an answer. Energy is another key. If you want to spiritualize your relationships, remember that all really spiritual consciousness is high energy, not low energy. Some people think they're being spiritual when they're really merely being absent-minded or abstract. To be spiritual in your relations with people means then in this context to give them your energy. Master used to say, when you're with people, be with them wholeheartedly. And then when you're with God, be completely with Him. But if you're going to do a thing, whatever it is, put your whole concentration into it. And if you're with people, give them your concentration. Try to feel that God is blessing them through your eyes. Smile with your eyes. Don't merely smile with your mouth. Hey, that's a funny joke you just told. Put your heart into it. Let your soul shine through your eyes. Be completely with them. And you'll find that then you begin to draw them out of themselves, and the two of you begin to find in your friendship a relationship with God. Another thing to keep in mind is that people, being what they are on varying levels of receptivity, varying levels of refinement. Not everybody whom you meet, not everybody whose lot and yours are thrown together, will be equally receptive or capable of responding in a spiritual way. I know that one of the things that made Ananda possible was giving energy there where it seemed that it would have the most results. Putting energy out to those who were in tune, rather than saying, well, they're in tune, we can forget about them, and let's put all our energy into the people who aren't in tune, hoping that we'll bring them around. You'll find that after a great deal of effort, the chances are you might bring one around, but most of it will be lost. You'll do a lot better trying to develop those relationships that already have something going for them. There are some people whom you meet that you feel instantly in attunement with. There is a soul connection that has come from other lifetimes. Develop those relationships, because those are relationships that you've already developed to some extent, and it won't take that much work to develop further. Remember in the last analysis that you're not here to develop relationships at all, except with God. The ultimate and only reality and only lover is God. And so it is that in your relationship with other people, you should seek above all that kind of relationship that will help you to come closer to God. You can have other kinds of friendship too, people who you enjoy working with, sharing intellectual thoughts and interests with, whatever it might be. But your real friends should be those whom you don't necessarily talk a lot with, but with whom you feel a kind of a divine harmony that brings you more and more close to your inner self. Ultimately, friendships should be used to spiritualize your relationship with God, and thus your relationship with God used in a way to spiritualize your relationship with others should be ultimately directed toward this spiritual union where you discover that you are at home everywhere, because wherever you go, you see your beloved shining in the eyes of strangers, in the eyes of even self-styled enemies. Like that story Master told of a saint who had a critic from any group. This man would always be there saying something against him and showing how he was wrong and so on. And finally, one day, a disciple came running joyfully to the guru, and he said, "Master, Master, your enemy, the critic, has died." And the master wept. He said, "I've lost my best friend. Only he dared to tell me the things none of you would tell me." That was his greatness, that he was willing to see help from all sides and to take it in that way. Always accept whatever comes as coming from God and give it back to God. Always be centered in yourself and share with that godly center in others. And you will see thus that your relationships will become really divine and a source of great joy and comfort to you. Very few people have the kind of friendships we have here because they haven't discovered these simple truths. But once you have them, you find you can be, everybody becomes your own. And you feel at home not only here, but everywhere you go. You greet perfect strangers, and at first they sort of look taken aback because you're looking at them as if they were old friends. But it doesn't take more than a moment or two before they're starting to feel, "Oh, this is a friend. I don't know his name, but he's a friend." And if you live in that way, you'll find that God looks at you. As it says in the Bhagavad Gita, "He who watches me, him do I watch. He never loses sight of me, nor do I lose sight of him."